Welcome to Hearing Voices, the best of public radio. From NPR, I'm Larry Massett, and today we're talking small towns. Really, really small, small towns. Towns like Tomato, Arkansas.
As you drive along the Mississippi River, you can't help noticing the levees. They're everywhere, 20-foot mounds of dirt snaking through woods and soybean fields. Often they're wide enough to pave on top, so the levee is also the main road. You hear the Army Corps of Engineers has got 2,000 miles of levees on the lower part of the river, and you think, great, everything's under control.
But then you notice that the levee doesn't always run right next to the river. In some places, it's miles from the water. These are places where the engineers knew that the river really wanted to change course and decided it wasn't worth the trouble to try to stop it. Now, the Corps of Engineers doesn't go around putting up signs that say, oh, the heck with everything for the next 10 or 12 miles. But you can tell. They don't have to draw you a picture.
You could take one from the waist up.
From the waist up? Okay.
I'm not going to even comb my hair, though, so you just take it as
okay.
Is.
All right, that sounds good.
But we're not taking any photographs inside the post office, okay? It might be illegal. There might be some kind of law about taking pictures in a post office.
That's what I told the people from the Arkansas Gazette. I didn't want to do anything to jeopardize my job.
That's just some kind of federal rule?
I don't know if it's a rule. Oh. That's why I say I don't really know. But I don't want to do anything to jeopardize my job because this is the only thing I can do and live here.
Emily Lee runs a post office in Tomato, Arkansas. It's a tourist attraction for people traveling down the Mississippi River because it's probably the smallest post office in the United States. It's an old smokehouse is what it is, 10 feet by 12, and just tall enough to stand up in.
It's definitely big enough for the town of Tomato, though. As far as we can see, Emily Lee is Tomato. There's the smokehouse here, and a somewhat bigger house where Emily and her husband live, and beyond that, nothing. There's a great flat stretch of mud, probably used to be farmland, baking in the sun, and a couple of trees, and the Mississippi River right behind the post office.
We have a backwater here every year. We've cut off about 11 weeks this year. Most of Tomato has already caved in the river. It's probably on the Tennessee side now.
What was it like, you know, when you were growing up here? Was this a kind of...
Oh, it was really nice. For a small place, there was lots of people here. At one time, when they took the census, it was 357. It was like a big family. Some people said we live back in sticks, but it didn't ever seem that way to us. Back then, you know, we have dances, we have parties, guitar and fiddle, harp. We made our own fun. We used to have three stores and three churches and a school. And they're all gone.
Why? What happened?
Well, in the 70s, I don't know just what year, we had three bad waters. And people got afraid they was going to lose everything they had. And some of them moved their houses, and some bought land and built new ones, just to get out of this backwater.
Has it been sort of sad seeing people, you know?
Oh, sure, it's been sad. I stood here and cried when the Baptist church was moved.
Where did it go?
They auctioned it off, and a man bought it and made apartments out of it. It gets lonesome now, you know, so many people gone, but we still love it. And most of the ones that has left here will tell you today they'd rather live here. It's anywhere they ever lived. But they had to get out. I don't know where we'll go when we have to leave here. I've been here all but about 2 or 3 years of my life.
As you leave Tomato, you find yourself hoping that the Mississippi never floods again. Emily Lee likes the place a lot, even if it is inconvenient. And it's still possible to get a book of stamps here without having to wait in a long line.
If you will get a zip code directory or anything and look up a lot of other states, you'll see names worse than Tomato.
When Scott Carrier and I made that trip to Tomato in 1980-something, it looked like it was about to slide into the river. I checked the map just now, and apparently it's still there. There are towns that really have gone all the way underwater, though. Sean Cole tells this story.
The Quabbin Reservoir serves 46 cities and towns in Massachusetts, mostly in the Boston area. On an alphabetical list of those cities and towns, number one is Arlington, where I happen to live. When I first heard that four towns were flooded to build the reservoir, I imagined a little Atlantis down there, but the water coursed through some intact village on its way to my faucet, and it was kind of haunting. But the reality is even more haunting, particularly for some of the people that used to live in the towns. And the longer they talk about Dana, Greenwich, Prescott, and Enfield, the more the four towns tend to meld into one town, an idyllic place they can still rebuild in their minds.
It was a very interesting little town.
I remember a Doubleday store.
They had a store, we had a hotel.
I remember the common, a church.
They had schools.
School.
A congregational church.
They had a town hall.
They talk about the farms and the mills, and they talk about the river.
The Swift River.
Its three branches defining the valley, giving it its name.
The train that ran parallel with that river right through the towns was called the Rabbit. So we had the Rabbit, and the Rabbit left in 36, and then we knew we were doomed then. This is where my grandmother, my father's mother, lived. And then this little house right here behind me. My name is Robert Wilder. I was born in Enfield, Massachusetts. I left there in 1938. Consequently, now this is all under 107 feet of water. So in order to go home again, I would have to have scuba gear.
Bob Wilder wasn't even born yet when plans for the Quabbin began. It was around 1890 that Boston started searching for a solution to its water shortage. The story goes that an engineer was fishing in the Swift River Valley and noticed it made a perfect bowl. And if the river was dammed in just two places, that bowl would fill up.
Any altitude was over 500 feet above Boston. So an engineering mind very quickly says, well, if you can deliver that to Boston, you won't have to pump it.
The Quabbin was in the planning stages so long that a lot of people thought it would never be built. But then, in little more than a decade, the state forced everyone in the valley out of their homes, shortchanging them on their houses and land.
That was my childhood, is listening to people talk about who was moving.
This is Lois Barnes, former resident of Prescott and Greenwich.
How soon they were moving, where they were moving, who didn't want to move. It made me a radical. It really did.
How so?
Well, because it made me feel that the state could not be trusted.
And it will always be that way in my family. Always we will. I never go to Boston. I would never go to Boston if my life depended on it, because there's so much anger at what they did and the unfeeling. There was no safety nets. We were just thrown out.
Losing your home may be one of the most traumatic things that can happen to you, especially when you're a kid. Still, after 65 years, I thought everyone who was thrown out of the valley would have gotten over it. But some of them haven't. And hearing how the Quabbin was built, I can kind of understand why. The towns weren't just destroyed. They were unmade. By 1936, hundreds of workmen from Boston were swarming the valley, felling nearly every building, every tree.
At the end of it, we would go over and watch, and they would pile up the piles, not only of buildings that were knocked down, but of the brush that had been cut down.
They would push brush, buildings, anything that was left into a pile and light a match.
I think the best description would probably be, it was like stepping into hell, because the whole valley was afire.
It was fire all the time. And smoke. There was a real feeling of, you know, this is the end. This is the end.
But it was heartbreaking, too, because now for the first time, looking at the denuded land, you could see the bed of the railroad track. You could see the path of the river so clear, so well-defined. And it didn't look so large. It looked smaller then. The valley looks much smaller because it wasn't filled with things.
It took 7 years for the valley to fill up with water. A lot of the people forced out of the valley settled in the surrounding area. Most of them are dead now. Those who remain tend to hold on to what's left of the lost towns as much as they can. Some of those artifacts are kept at the Swift River Valley Historical Society in New Salem, Mass.
We made a little schoolroom here.
Former Greenwich resident Harvey Dickinson showed me around the museum.
But anyway, there's some school bells. This is the bell that used to bring me back to class. So a lot of people who did live in a valley like to come back and see these things that can relive some of their childhood here.
And some of them can relive their childhood by visiting the actual land that surrounds the Quabbin. That's something I wasn't expecting to hear. Most of the land that was taken to build the reservoir is still above water, so some people who lived in the valley will go back and visit their old roads and cellar holes. They visit cellar holes, the way some of us might drive by our childhood homes. And the thing they say about visiting the Quabbin, along with how nostalgic it makes them, is what a beautiful place it is now, full of trees and wildlife, clean shoreline, and how they wouldn't change it back if they could.
It's very hard for people to change, and I find that I had adapted to that whole concept that that's what life is all about, is change. And therefore, I've seen life as a challenge rather than as a fixed place, even though I long for that fixed place sometimes.
Even Bob Wilder, the angriest of the former Valley residents I've talked to, says his anger's been diluted by the waters of the Quabbin. He says he's realized over time that what happened to his hometown wasn't simply a tragedy. After all, he says, 2.5 million people in the Boston area needed water. And what would he rather have done? Let them go without?
It was almost the most you could possibly give, you know? When I joined the service and we had a hot war going and I went and did that, I thought that was the greatest contribution in my life. Until later in my life when I realized, no, it wasn't. That was my life. This is 2.5 million lives that we were affecting. There's the contribution.
X-Town, produced by Sean Cole for the Third Coast Audio Festival. You're listening to Small Town on Hearing Voices. Next, Ben Adair tells us about a town that's not even underwater. It's worse than that. Technically, it doesn't exist at all.
About an hour southeast of Palm Springs is what some call the last free place in America. It's a sort of drifter camp / RV park that, due to a bureaucratic technicality, is under nobody's jurisdiction. It's free. Only for the people who live there, there's still something missing.
Crossing Main Street. This is a city like any other city. South Side's the suburbs, those gleaming motorhomes. We're now at the Mission. Poverty Flats is that way. I'm just out here looking for myself. I'm Charlie LaDuff. I write about the West for the New York Times. So,
where are we exactly?
It's Slab City. 640 acres of a former military base where Patton trained, just east of the Salton Sea, where they practiced dropping dummy A-bombs. And it would be, I don't know what, an hour southeast of Palm Springs, about 40 miles north of Mexico, basically. Up here is where Rusty lives. He's some kind of veteran, I'm not sure, you know. Veteran of hard knocks, but he'll tell you. Calls himself the outcast. What's in your pocket?
That ain't none of your business. What's in my pocket is in my pocket.
And so, that's kind of why you live out here?
Partly. It's privacy, freedom, you know, be able to have neighbors, but not right on top of me. you know.
What are you doing out here?
Surviving. Living out my days. Trying to help keep people free. And doing whatever I can to help if I'm able to.
Remember you talking about how this country's, built by who? It's the West. And in the old days, if you didn't like it, if you couldn't handle society, you just marched west.
Well, you did that for a lot of reasons. The pioneers, the outlaws, the rejects, adventurous rebels, they helped build this country. Built and created it for people, not for a government. The government was created for us. We weren't created for the government. They seem to try to twist that around, and that ain't right. And don't get me wrong, I love my country. I'll fight and die for it under that flag. And I'd kill somebody to try to take it down. And I'm going to do my best until I die to make it work and be better for these guys and the people over there and the people right here and some drunken wino bum out there, because this is where he is. And he's trying to live out his life the best he can. And that's what I'm for, trying to keep it for all of us, Like I said the other day, there's somebody out there in the road maybe heading here, not even knowing it, but he may need this place, to make it and get back on his feet,
Do you want to get out of here?
Eventually.
You don't want to die here?
Not particularly.
Where you want to die?
In the mountains, by a stream, up north, on my own land. Then I can go happy. And I have my friends bury me, and just and they come around asking, oh, he took off a couple months ago. He said he was going to town. Ain't seen him since. Then after that, put a marker on my grave and fire a few shots, have a drink, whatever.
See, I got a theme. My theme's now, it's kind of like, it's loneliness, It's the last place, be yourself. Yeah, I know, there's plenty of, free places where you could live, and they'd leave you alone, but no person's a hermit, Prophets and pilgrims go to the desert, but a hermit doesn't. Hermits die, and these people don't really want to die. They might be waiting to die, but they don't want to die. That's the pastor. His lady just passed away about 6 months ago after 49 years, so he came to minister to these people, but this year I think they're finally giving back because he needs them more than anybody knows.
I don't fear death at all. I feel it, I fear it much less now. I mean, the idea of leaving this world and this old worn-out body and it's wearing out, that doesn't frighten me at all. I mean, since my wife has gone on ahead of me, when the day comes when the good Lord taps me in the shoulder and said, now, son, it's time to come home, I'll probably say, praise the Lord. I'm ready, I really don't know where to begin unless I said it would begin back in 1953 when I met a girl, and as many of us young fellows do, I was really attracted to her. 2 years later, we married, and she stayed by my side through all of those years, through the good times and through the bad times. But last winter, in February the 12th, she had a massive stroke. So I had to cut my winter term here at Slab City short. I got a card shortly after she passed away from all of the people here at Slab City. And all of the people had signed that card. Even the people that don't come to church had signed the card, and they said, please come back to Slab City. We want you to come back. So if ever before in my life I needed to be around people and to feel needed and useful, it's now more than ever before. Overall, humanity prefers the anthill.
Even the hermits out here, you're not really a hermit. You need somebody.
Most of the ones, if you get to know them, that live off of themselves and they get to where they know you, to where they trust you, they'll just literally talk your leg off. It's because perhaps they may be hiding from something, or perhaps they've been hurt by people in the past, and so they want to shut the world out. But in reality, there's a loneliness and an emptiness there that you do need other people. can't get away from them. So. Well, hello there. My, it's been a long, long time. How am I doing? Guess I'm doing fine. Been so long now, but it seems like it was only yesterday. And ain't it funny how time slips away?
I'm Donna Lee. My last name is Cole.
Now tell me about over half of this society, this culture, these 10,000 elderly Americans out there, crashed it all in and just are on the road year-round.
You're looking at us. When my husband died, I made a conscious choice. I did not want to sit in my home and feel sorry for myself. And I hit the road. I just did. 10 months after my husband died, I hit the road.
Sold it all and left?
I own property in Florida, but I never go there. A few people in here own homes, but every year that goes by, a few more don't. We sell it. We give it up. We don't... I just want to be free. And that's what we are.
You kissed a man since your husband passed away? Come on. I said kiss. That's all I
asked. Of course. Yeah, of course. Yeah, I'm not dead. I'm just widowed.
And ain't it funny how time slips away? And it's funny how time slips away.
Slab City was produced by Ben Adair. Hearing Voices will be back in a minute with another Small Town.
Hearing Voices is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes a great nation deserves great art. From NPR, this is HearingVoices.com.
Welcome back to Small Town on Hearing Voices. The next town we'll visit is kind of subtle. At first, as you'll hear, it doesn't seem to be a town, just a song, an old folk song.
When John Henry was a little bitty boy, you could set him on the palm of your hand. John Henry's mammy looked down at him and said, "My Johnny gonna be a steel-driving man, Papa. Johnny gonna be a steel-driving man."
John Henry, some said he was a black man, and then others teached he was a white man. And so I don't know now. Probably he was a black man, John Henry, of a steel-driving man.
John Henry, as far as I can find out, actually existed, and he must have been a pretty good fellow. He was a mighty man, and the truth of it.
He was a little over 6 feet tall, weighed about 200 pounds. He wasn't a rough house man. He was well-liked by those who worked with him.
Nobody knows actually what size man he was, but he was just an ordinary citizen and an ex-slave. A lot of people think it's a myth. We don't know.
All right, boys and girls, you know we have been talking about stories. Well, today we have a story about a person that we're not sure is a real person, or it could be a make-believe person. And this person comes from around here. It's a big person.
A giant.
No, not a giant.
John Henry.
Okay, we passed that statue. Today's story is about John Henry.
Now John Henry was a little boy, sitting on his mammy's knee. He picked up a hammer and a little bit of steel. The hammer gonna be the death of me. Hammer gonna be the death of me.
One day, John Henry and Polly Ann were walking through the hills of West Virginia. There were hammers ringing. Men were hammering and singing. They were building the Big Bend Tunnel on the Chesapeake and Ohio Railroad, going right through the mountain, right where we live today. You can look over there on that railroad track below the tunnel, and you can see that. Okay, come on back. The trees are hiding it right now, okay? Come on back.
The tunnel started in 1870. Labor was done mostly by the Irish and blacks.
There were a lot of freed slaves that were looking for jobs, so they drifted towards this area. So my ancestors and my husband's drifted in here.
At that time, there was no modern machinery, but they did have people who were good at driving an iron bar.
It's like a huge crowbar, you know, with a star-shaped point on it, and the shaker boy turned it back and forth every time he'd hit it, and it made it cut into the stone.
And it took two men to work with this. One of them was called a shaker, and his job was to lift the bar up and twist it. And the other was to hit the bar and drill through.
It was, at best, back-breaking work, long hours, low pay, and at worst, incredibly dangerous because there really were no very good safeguards against accidents. There were many deaths building the Big Bend Tunnel.
Now John Henry said to the captain, man, you ought to see me swing. I weigh 49 pounds from my hips on down. I love to hear that cold steel ring. I love to hear that cold steel ring.
The coming of the railroad meant enormous changes. It had been a largely white area, and it was really very isolated. And I've thought about this a lot, and I can't even imagine what it must have been like suddenly to have all this equipment and all these new people and this tunnel going through this mountain. It must just have been astonishing.
They invented a little old steam drill years ago, you know. And John Henry didn't want to be drove down. We said before he'd see the steam drill drive him down, he'd die with the hammers in his hand. And that's true. That's true, yeah. That's a true song.
My grandparents moved here when they were building the tunnel. I've heard them talk about John Henry. We just grew up listening to all of them, you know, just talking about that.
When I worked at the Big Bend Tunnel, I heard stories about the legend about John Henry and all with the men that I worked with.
Uncle Banks, Terry, who lived to be, say, 113 when he died, he didn't see John Henry, but he heard everybody talking about the machine and the man that tried to beat the machine.
Said, before I see this steam drill drive me down, I'll die with these hammers in my hand, Lord, Lord, I'll die with these hammers in my hand.
John Henry knew that there were several workers wanting a job. And this machine, if it could do the work, it was going to cut a whole lot of people out of jobs. So he said, no machine can do what a human can do.
I can imagine John Henry looking at that machine and say, shucks, I don't think that machine can beat me. And then the captain, I can imagine they was all betting, hey, look, man, captain going to put John Henry against that machine out there. And some of them taking, no, John Henry, see, he ain't going to never get nowhere with that. And, you know, and some talking about, yeah, I believe he will, too. I bet John Henry can beat that machine. And next thing, they might be bet money on that, stuff like that. And then at the day of that contest when John Henry got up in that Big Bend Tunnel and started driving them spikes, boy, I tell you, and that machine by his side, boy.
And John Henry hammered in the mountainside till his hammer was striking fire. And the last words I heard the poor boy say, "Cool drink of water for a dime. Give me a cool drink of water for a dime."
The whistle blew. The race was over. John Henry has beaten the machine. Everyone clapped their hands and stomped around and laughed and carried on. Polly Ann came running over with the baby. When he got there, John Henry was laying on the ground. "I feel a little tuckered out," he said, "but I beat that machine, didn't I? Just like I said I would." John Henry reached for the baby with one hand and for his hammer with the other, and then he smiled and closed his eyes. "I think he's gone," Little Will said. "He's gone," said Polly Ann. Polly Ann nodded. He was the best, the very best.
Aww.
You can't convince many people here but what John Henry actually lived. Too many local people have passed down from generation to generation enough history of John Henry. We have no doubt of what he lived.
I'm so much convinced that John Henry was such a real person that I would gamble my life on it.
There's, I guess, about as much chance as tracing the historical John Henry as there is the historical Jesus.
That's the trouble. What's happened? If we had all the history written down that could have been passed down from generation to generation, we would have a solid core to stand on.
You can't find a birth date and a death date for him like you can George Washington, Carver, Booker T. Washington. They're the ones that we sort of trot out in our elementary school textbooks. John Henry has never needed that kind of artificial insemination or whatever you'd care to call it. John Henry's sort of been in our collective face all of this time.
A lot of people use John Henry as a kind of role model, you know. Almost anywhere you would go in the black community where people were playing blues and playing folk music, like, there would always be somebody come up and say, "Hey, do you know John Henry?"
He lived almost entirely in oral tradition, and so lots of different people made of John Henry many different kinds of men, and it contributes to the way in which he's a universal kind of hero, and lots of different people can claim him and make him their own.
As you enter Talkett from the west or the east, you'll see a sign that says Talkett, home of John Henry legend, and welcome.
When you come in Talkett, it looks like a little valley between the mountains of the hills. And in the center of this valley, you will find the river. Beside of it's a track, and beside of the track, the state highway.
We're crossing the main line, which is the lines being in use today. We're entering the area where the old track used to be in the Big Bend Tunnel. It's now closed and growed up. You can't hardly get there. The hole is still, right now we can see the hole in the mountain. We're walking through a maze of cross ties and snake infested areas.
I graduated in 1930. Back then, this was a big freight station, and the railroad had a booming business here. I can remember the depot over here. My dad would pick up wire and fencing and fertilize and seed to haul it back to the farm. And I still live on the same farm, still farming.
Talkett was a big place. They had a station down there. And we'd go down to the station and watch the people get on and ones get off for every train in the evening.
Oh, there was a gang of trains running years ago here, and they all stopped. The number 3, number 4, number 5, number 6, and 13, 14.
13, 14. There was quite a few trains that stopped here. All of that was years ago.
About the end of the 40s, they tore the depot down. No trains stop here now.
The coal industry has in West Virginia has gone down. There used to be a big yard office, a switching yard in Hinton, and that's completely gone. And that's what's called the depression in this area. This depletion of the railroad industry. It's just about gone anymore.
And so we're down until very few people are employed. It just drained the population.
We have quite a few retired people, and quite a few people in our area are on welfare because they can't find work and they can't afford to pick up what they have here and move away between a rock and a hard place. John Henry supposedly was the fastest spike driver on the railroad. He ever worked for the railroad. He could drive a spike in so many licks, hit it so many times, and the spike would be in. Manual labor done all the railroad work. They drove every spike, set every tie by hand. The steam drill came along, and it hit it one time and knocked it plumb through this cross tie. So now you have a whole bunch of machines and four or five men go down the railroad track putting in ties and rail and spikes, and they do the whole thing. So automation has taking its toll.
This always happens every time there's a technological advance. What happens to the people who are displaced? Manual labor suddenly becomes obsolete because of the technological takeover. It's something we're still encountering in the 20th century. We've played versions of the John Henry drama throughout our entire history as a people, I think.
When they got ready to put the tunnel, they bought all the property down through there. And some of that people didn't want to sell to the river. They just condemned it and took it. And when the first state road came through here, Miss Crockett, her grandfather owned a house on the river, and they wanted to buy her grandfather's home. And he didn't want to sell. His children had been raised there and everything. They just condemned it and took it.
When I was a child, I used to stay with my grandparents a lot down on the river. Then when they put the highway through, they blasted that place up, and they had to move. I wrote a poem about that.
Get it here somewhere.
Can I read it to you? This place was a heaven to me. On the banks of the Greenbrier River, where the sun shines bright each day, I spent a happy childhood with my grandparents old and gray. While the whippoorwill sang me to sleep each night, and the crickets chirped with glee, the frogs, the owls, and katydids, that place was a heaven to me. My grandparents were the Evans, who I'm sure everyone knows, Uncle Cal and Aunt Ada, as the saying goes. They lived by the Greenbrier River for more than 30 years, down close to the Big Bend Tunnel. The old place still seems so dear. We all lived there so happy until that awful day. The state decided to build a road, then they had to move away. It broke our hearts to leave there. But the state had other plans. They were building a state highway, and they had to take their land. My grandparents both are dead now. They died with a broken heart. The old home place they loved so well, I'm sure they never forgot. I go there every summer, just to fish and swim. There's no one there to greet me, and no home to enter in. I often sit and wonder just why it had to be. The old home place we loved so well was more than a heaven to me.
People say that Talca doesn't change, it's the same. But if you go away, you'll see there's a lot of changes. I notice the change is their names. So many, everybody mostly, had to leave Talca to get jobs. And there's not always near as many people.
You look out here now, and you see a couple kids playing together. Back when I was a kid, they'd be 15 or 20 gathered up in some fields and we're kicking an old ball around.
I don't really see myself coming back after I graduate because there's really no industry around in Summers County, no major businesses. I've always had a part of me wanting to live in a city.
We have one daughter that she's in Pennsylvania because there was no work here. She hates to be away from home, but, you know, she's in a small area, and she enjoys it, and I don't think she'll ever come back. There's nothing to bring her back here.
It's a shame that when young people finish their education, that they can't find some employment. And the young people don't like to go back to the farms. You don't get rich on a farm. You can exist.
I've always liked living here. The ones I graduated with, a lot of them have moved away to college and married and stuff. But I still see them every now and then. And I don't like the city. I like the country. I like the quiet. I really don't want to move away.
If you see anybody from here that were maybe 50 years ago, they used to live here, they want to come back to Talkett. And they are buried, a lot of them, in the cemetery now. They always come back to Talkett.
If you were to drive through the Talkett area from east to west, all the way through Talkett, you would see the CNO Railroad, which was the CNO Railway, which is CSX now.
Let's see, going west, there's the old swimming hole. First thing that you would notice on the river.
The swimming hole was a place that even in back in the day, like in the 40s and 50s, was not segregated. Other places in Talkett were, you know, the black people had their place of living, white people had their place of living, but the swimming hole was like a meeting place. Everybody went there. Okay, I'm taking you to the old swimming hole in Talkett. It's like trees that are very old, and some are leaning over towards the river. Lush undergrowth, and like a camper there, and it's like a little island, we call it. And it's just a beautiful, peaceful place. Other places on down lower was the baptismal place for the church. And the older people who can't come down because of the rock cliff, they will stand up there and sing or pray. Baptized my son a year ago here.
Our Baptist church is called the Second Baptist Church of Talkett, but it's across the highway and the railroad track from the Rollinsburg Church. It's all white. At times we have joined our congregations. There's no malice, as I have seen, but we have two separate churches.
There's been, a general decline in church attendance, really. Of course, the church is like anything else. It goes up and down. You know, sometimes you have good prosperity, and then sometimes you kind of level off and maybe take a dip or two before you come back up again.
In times like these, you need a Savior. In times like these, you need an anchor. Be very sure. Be very sure your anchor holds and grips the solid rock.
The next thing you would see would probably be a railroad crossing. Just before you would cross this crossing, there's a post office. We do have a post office here.
My name is Mr. Dillon. I'm postmaster here at Talkett, West Virginia. It's a small community, but it's a very tight-knit community, and most everybody knows everybody. Afternoon.
Afternoon.
How you doing today?
As you cross this railroad crossing, you would find the only grocery store in our community, and run by a very nice family.
Running a small little country grocery store, Dillon Superette. I'm pretty well familiar with everybody. I've lived here all my life, and you know, if anybody wants to know anything, fire trucks goes out, our phone starts ringing. Where's the fire truck going? If anybody has a wreck or if anybody is sick or anybody in the hospital, you know, they'll call here. Well, they think we know everything, but we don't.
Same thing.
$5.50.
You know, you keep coming back. You know, this is still home.
Oh, yeah. A place like home.
As you continued past the post office, there's a road on the right-hand side. It turns into a place called Pie Holler. And this is a black community, basically black community. Most of them live in this area and have lived there for years and years.
In the days when John Henry was building the tunnel, it was sort of segregated, and the Holler was the place where all the black people lived. And to this day, it's still that way.
They're colored, they're up there. But I go up there every once in a while to visit them, and a lot of our friends are up there.
When I was a kid, I went into their homes and sat down at the table and ate with them and played with them, and there's some fine people.
Talking has always, we had no trouble. We knew that some certain things that we were not supposed to do, like going in front, we were supposed to go around to the side and all that. It was just accepted. But I can't say that there was ever any real trouble.
It's quiet and there's good people here. There's a lot of colored, but they're good people. They come in here when these works was going on years ago, and of course another generation ago, but the old generation was fine people, and they all got along, worked together and everything. We had good times. A lot of them now is my friends. They stopped by and see me. And I worked with them on CNO. A lot of the porters rode the train.
I'll tell you how it is. There's four sons that I have, and they had married four white girls. My grandmother was half white and half Indian. So I couldn't bring up a child to hate anybody, either side. And I tried not to. People to people.
And if you continue on down the road, there we have what I call a beer joint, and our school road is right beside of this, goes up onto up to a hill to where our local school is at. Okay, if you continue past the schoolhouse road, on the left-hand side of the road, almost to the top of the mountain, you'd be directly over the tunnels that John Henry supposedly built.
The old tunnel still stands with the brick arch. The water drips through the brick. You can go there and see the water dripping and hear it dripping in the tunnel even yet today.
This tunnel is the Great Bend Tunnel, which is the tunnel that John Henry supposedly drove a spike in, had a heart attack, and died racing with a steam drill. Would have happened right here where we're standing in this general area. Looking in the tunnel, the track is gone and the water is dripping through the tunnel. As we stand here and look, we can see a small light, which is the other end of the tunnel, which is some 9/10 of a mile away. And we can only barely see a small light because of the debris that has fallen somewhere in the middle of the tunnel.
When it rains like it is today, that water dropping down in there, and you can hear ping, ping, just like a hammer, and they say it's John Henry's. You can hear it. You get a feeling of other people.
You look into it, and it's foggy and misty, and it looks like the water's... I mean, it just looks like a river inside of it. And see a few pop cans, cross ties laying in front of the tunnel. It's just total blackness, and you can feel the wetness in the air.
It's really dangerous for us to be here. I'm ready to get out of here.
In 73, the statue of John Henry was erected up there, right on top of Big Bend Tunnel.
The statue has been rocked and bombed and drug down and tore down by children, but he's there, and I guess in the hearts of the people of this community, it's something I guess that we cling to.
People do stop at the statue. I believe that it could be a profitable thing if Talkit would talk it up more, or like if we'd had a ball team named the Steel Drivers or something like that.
There's a lot of community spirit here. If we can get the ball field fenced, we can give the go-ahead and get some little league goes up there, and that'll be another addition and attraction to add with John Henry.
Early Monday morning on the eastbound train, couldn't hardly stay in bed. Early Monday morning on the eastbound train, going where John Henry was dead. Going where John Henry was dead.
What makes me love that song is a feeling in it, a feeling in John Henry. That's what makes it so holding on. It goes to you what makes it hold on, going through the people to remember it and singing it yet with their music.
The story still stands. Even today, they probably got machines out there that can drive 10 times as fast as John Henry drove them spikes. But he had made a mark that people will forever look up to him.
John Henry was helped along by the folk song process, which is that the song stayed important because it was important. It's a little microcosm of an ongoing American conflict that we all understand.
It's nice that you live in a community where you know everybody, but you have some history that you can always identify with no matter where you go. Somebody has heard that legend. And nice being able to say, well, I'm postmaster where John Henry beat the steam drill.
You can't keep nothing looking like nothing around here on this river, but I wouldn't trade it for nothing in the world. I love the river.
I've been to most of the large cities, and after I see everybody, I begin to think about coming home. These mountains, you notice there's mountains all the way around, and you feel protected. The song says, from Allegheny's lofty peaks to mountains towards the west, there lies a state whose mooring speaks of beauty and the best. And West Virginia's scenic grandeur is a boon to every eye, and a mountain's tall, commanding, shoulders out the very sky. So that's the way I feel about West Virginia.
Steel Driving Man was produced by Jenna Allison. The music was from Doc Watson, Mississippi John Hurt, John Cephas. I'm Larry Massett. This is HearingVoices.com.
Hearing Voices is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes a great nation deserves great art. Our producers are Scott Carrier, Ann Hepperman, Larry Massett, and Kara Oler. Our intern is Max Darum. Mix engineer is Robin Wise of SoundImagery.com. Executive producer is Barrett Golding. From NPR, National Public Radio, this is HearingVoices.com.